Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Security Ledger podcast. I'm your host, Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief of the Security Ledger. When the world's top hackers and security experts gathered in Las Vegas last week for the DEF CON hacking conference, the security of election systems was put under the microscope in a voting village where attendees could try their hand at compromising some of the hardware and software that's used to tabulate votes and decide elections throughout the United States. According to news reports, it wasn't much of a contest. The first voting machine fell within minutes. By the end of the weekend, every one of the roughly 30 voting machines, vote tabulators, and portable devices that are used to check voters in at the polls had been compromised. Sadly, this is nothing new. Many of the devices in use today have been known to be vulnerable for years. How did we get here, and who or what could possibly lead our big, diverse, and seemingly divided nation out of the thicket? In this week's podcast, we talked to two experts on the security of election systems to find out.
Yes, my name is Beth Harris, and I'm an author. I also founded an organization called Black Box Voting. Black box voting is focused on transparency in the election process. Black box signifying something where the public can't look inside or understand how it was, how they came up with the numbers they came up with. The opposite would be transparency or white box, I guess you'd call it. The crux of the problem is not the machine that's used. The crux of the problem is, can the public verify, the public, any person, like with freedom of information involves any person, can the public verify that the count is true or false? And that requires a paper ballot, but it also requires that the public be able to look at that under freedom of information law.
You said you were at DEF CON, but you did not go to the vote hacking village because you already knew what they were going to find, which was that these systems were very vulnerable. Do you think that those demonstrations are useful, or are they misleading or overblown? I mean, many of the hacks they talk about are, you know, require physical access to the voting machine, hooking a keyboard up to it, for example. Things that, while concerning, probably aren't scalable to affect, you know, a huge number of votes.
Not true.
Okay.
Not true.
Okay.
Let's look at bank taking money from banks, stealing from banks. About 68% of all funds ever stolen from banks is stolen by someone with inside access. Historically, with elections, typically they were stolen by someone with inside access. The idea that only an outside hacker would steal an election is actually not very realistic. It typically would be somebody who has some level of inside access. There's inside access at the local level, and then through these middlemen and contractors, there's people who have inside access at a multiple level. And then you have the foreign powers, which would have fairly sophisticated ways to get at multiple middlemen at once. So there's several levels, and that's why I think that we don't want to focus on a Homeland Security type style solution where, oh, let's make it even more opaque and encrypted and controlled by a single party. Instead, you make sure that the public can see and authenticate everything anytime they want to. It basically crowdsources the authentication process. I used to worry a lot about who the vendors were and where they, and it's relevant, but you have to take, let's say you just make the assumption that somebody somewhere, you don't know who, an insider, is going to do something they shouldn't. That's the thing you protect against. And the way to protect against that is by opening it up and crowdsourcing the authentication.
The New York Times had an op-ed, I think, earlier this week, to protect voting, use open source software. I wonder if you saw that and what your thoughts on that argument are.
It's one thing that's a good thing. It doesn't solve it. It doesn't give you public transparency. There is one definite benefit that I've seen. When I've been out in the field attempting to authenticate, a lot of times I'll want to see an audit log or a database or, you know, the program that did it. And it would take away their ability to say, you can't see the audit log because it's proprietary. We can't show you, the program that did the system because it's proprietary. It would make it subject to freedom of information. But open source in and of itself doesn't solve the transparency problem, but it helps.
So in your opinion, it's almost a certainty then that either errors or tampering with electronic voting systems have tipped elections in one way or the other in the United States.
Oh, yeah, that it's happened. And there's a lot of documented situations. Now, whether it's an error or tampering is probably not knowable in most cases. So you have to basically say that we need to be able to tell whether it's the numbers they're reporting are true or false. And regardless of whether it's human error or intent, it's not okay. And we know that, although they often claim it's human error, we know that elections have been misreported, sometimes ridiculously so. In Arkansas, there was an election where they actually gave votes to the wrong race. For example, they gave sheriff's votes to a judge. You know, it was like not even the right thing on the ballot that right. got it. And clearly it was wrong. There's been a number of elections they've had to rerun because it was, they call it incurable uncertainty, where they never could figure out who should have won because of the way the machine was counting. So that part we know, and we know it will continue to happen. We know that the nature of computers is, there will be both human errors and tampering. One of the things that I'm working on right now is a new book, which is going to address the issue, the particularly unique American way that corruption happens. And I started at the local level and was quite shocked, even, and I'm hard to shock, at the scale of corrupt officials. For example, the Department of Justice has to report every year. They have a division of public corruption investigations, and they have to report how many convictions they have every year. Now, keeping in mind there's about 3,500 counties, they have 1,000 convictions every year for public corruption. Well, the payload for rigging an election is to get a corrupt official into office. It's really not something that's even rare in the United States. Mm. The difference is, here in the U.S., we think corruption is some sort of foreign problem because we don't have the violence associated with it. We don't have the local guy, the policeman in the corner telling you you have to pay him cash in order to do this and that, or, you know, in order to get your driver's license, you have to give somebody some cash. We don't have that here. It's got a different flavor here. But it's actually quite widespread. And something that I think will be helpful, what I'm working on right now, is quantifying it and documenting it so that people can see that this is not a conspiracy theory. This is a fact of life. We're a good country. We prosecute it and we try to get these guys out of office. But you don't know at any given time if the people who are handling your votes are honest or not. And you shouldn't have to guess. You should be able to check.
I guess one way of looking at is at what you're saying is that there are motivations for rigging elections, that it might not be a grand conspiracy orchestrated from, you know, the suburbs of Washington, D.C., or it might be a much more local matter.
Yeah.
But that it isn't that uncommon, and that it's a manifestation of just corruption of the political within the political system.
Well, it's even money. It's if you look at right. this, again, quantifying it, there's one federal election every 4 years, but there's about 100,000 local elections, which control hundreds of billions of dollars in contract signing. The contract awarding process controls a tremendous amount of money. And, you know, actually, in the most vulnerable positions that I've found, the ones that have had the most problems of indictments and so forth, are sheriff, which controls guns, contraband, and drugs, city council and county commissioner type positions, because they control contract signing authority. And the contracts are huge. They're, you know, millions and millions of dollars for waste management and all those kind of things like that. And I was surprised and a little disheartened to find that the third most common one was judges, the judicial system. And their deal is they sometimes get bribes for delivering certain verdicts. And more often, they get kickbacks for putting people in certain correctional facilities. What's great about this kind of research is I'm not basing it on any kind of theory or conspiracy theory. I'm using the indictments themselves. And they have wiretaps of the people actually saying what they're doing. So You know, judges are elected at various levels, the sheriffs, these commissioners, and a lot of times they need to get elected because they are the key vote to get a particular waste management contract through or something, various different things. Public transportation is another area of graft sometimes. There is a real monetary incentive, and it's repeated thousands of times over in these different local places. It's important for Americans to understand that these temptations exist for our public officials, and that one of the mitigations is for us to be able to control, you know, who gets in office and really know that when they tell us that somebody got into office, that they really did get voted in.
You've said that you think the kind of locally based or state based election system, decentralized system, is a good thing, that you don't want it federally controlled. On the other hand, is there more that the federal government could be doing to shore up the integrity of this system short of taking control of it, you know, whole cloth? And if so, what?
Federal government, an appropriate area for it in terms of elections is civil rights protection. And civil rights is not just about minority rights or ethnic rights. It's also about public freedom of information rights. If they started to address the issue of the public right to know, the public right to authenticate, that would be an appropriate use of federal power. And they could leave it to the states as to how to enact that. And frankly, my position is if we can see and authenticate each essential step without special expertise, any method will do. I'm not that picky. This is the crux of the problem. And if we can start solidifying that right, articulating that right, and defining whether our solutions are really addressing it in terms of that right, we are really going to have some tangible improvement.
Bev, talk briefly just about what's going on right now. You guys blogged about Travis County in Texas and some of the,
right.
There's a legal challenge there by a candidate, Dr. Laura Presley, who was a candidate for city council, right, and lost, and then challenged the vote, which took place in 2015, because there was really no way to certify the vote. What was going on there?
Yeah, that's a very interesting case. She asked for a recount. Initially, her problem was, and it's a good one, there was insufficient randomness. In other words, she was in an original election, and then there was a runoff election. And in the original election, there was a whole bunch of candidates. And in the runoff election, there was only two. But in precinct after precinct, she got the identical percentage in both elections. And that's really statistically almost impossible to achieve, because if you're running against 10 candidates and then you're running against one, you're not likely to precinct after precinct score the exact same percentage.
Oh, so the percentages in the precincts were identical between the original kind of open race and then the runoff race. Her share of the vote was identical.
Correct. Anyone with a mathematical bent will realize that that's unlikely in the extreme. So then she asked for a recount, and under Texas law, you can choose to recount either just a machine recount, or you can look at the actual individual ballots one by one. And they had bragged, everybody had bragged, the local election official, the vendors, the county attorney, that these electronic voting systems were fine because they produced an individual record of each vote, and they called it an image of each ballot. Now, I've seen the images for Diebold touchscreens, paperless touchscreens, and they look like a ballot. It's kind of computer generated, but there's one for each vote and it has a unique ID on each one. However, they told her when she asked to see the images that, oh gosh, they didn't exist. She must mean a printout, which was basically they just gave her a table of numbers, which is not remotely similar to ballot images. And so she said, well, this is not a ballot image. I'm not allowed to see this. And this progressed into her being told a number of different things which just didn't hold water. For example, they then said, well, the Secretary of State can say that the Texas law doesn't apply. And
right.
That is one of the things she's taking to the Texas Supreme Court, because the law is made by elective legislators. When you realize we're supposed to have a checks and balances of an executive branch, which is Secretary of State, legislative branch, and courts, If you say the executive branch can just overrule legislation anytime they want, it would be like, well, what laws and why and when? I mean, wait a minute, because it's just like on one election. It didn't make any sense that they can just change it. So that's one issue she's got before the courts. And she's got another one because Texas law specifically defines what a ballot and a ballot image is. And it didn't meet that requirement. And she said, well, you know, do I have to accept a ballot that's actually illegal according to Texas law for my recount? So she's doing a really good job of parsing out the issues into things that are very tangible and that have not been clarified. And she's asking the Texas Supreme Court to clarify these things and say, you know, can they overrule it? She's not even asking them to redo her election. She's just saying, wait a minute, can they really do this?
And where does that stand? What's happening with that case?
Well, it's very interesting. It's not been resolved yet, although the Texas Supreme Court has asked for arguments from the other side, which means they haven't dismissed it yet. However, there is an attempt now to get a constitutional amendment through Texas, which would require the Supreme Court in Texas to ask the executive branch before it renders a decision, which again would be impacting the balance of power in horrific ways, actually. Why would you have a balance of power where the administrative branch can overrule the legislature and the courts have to ask them for permission before making a decision? So it's going to be interesting to see how it all plays out. I think it takes tremendous courage for her to do this. They attempted to punish her by assessing her almost $200,000 in fines for simply filing the suit.
And was that dismissed?
That's the third leg of her lawsuit is if I'm asking the courts to clarify discrepancies between practice and law, you know, between what they're doing and the law, can you sanction in that way? Because in the history of Texas jurisprudence, it has never been done that a candidate has been sanctioned for doing that.
I mean, all of these things sound profoundly anti-democratic.
It's a power grab. I think we are seeing attempts to do power grabs in a number of areas, not just elections. It isn't a situation where everybody can just sit back and go, well, you know, someone else has got it. I have tremendous respect for these citizens who have gone forth and said, look, this doesn't seem right. I am going to litigate pro se if necessary. It's really in an interesting stage for me, a kind of an optimistic stage, because I am seeing citizens step up to the plate and challenge, and they are winning fairly regularly.
Bev Harris of Black Box Voting, thanks for coming in and talking to Security Ledger.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bev Harris, the founder of Black Box Voting. That's an organization that's been highlighting cybersecurity weaknesses in voting systems since 2003. And we also talked to Eric Hodge, the director of consulting at CyberScout, which is working with the Board of Elections in Kentucky and other states to help secure election systems.
I'm Eric Hodge. I'm the director for consulting at CyberScout. CyberScout protects individuals' identities, companies' identities. We are a privacy firm first. Our approach to security is we start with the data, and we're concerned about the privacy of the data. And then from there, we try to figure out how to build secure systems that go around it. And that's kind of what voting is. It's the ultimate piece of private data, who you are and how you're voting in an election. We were first asked before the presidential election. Their concerns were raised because of what was in the news, because of concerns about interference from state actors overseas, from people trying to hack the election, from accusations from candidates that the system's rigged. And I think the secretaries of state and the election directors concerned about how that looked, how that made them look, and wanted to make sure that they had the right controls in place or had a set of outside eyes saying, hey, we're doing a good job here. What we did was we stepped back and took a look at what's actually had an effect, what's actually worked, and then categorized that into four areas, four valid concerns that we think represent risks that need to be mitigated. First, it's protecting the voter rolls. We saw in Illinois and Arizona in particular last year what looked like state actors making successful attempts to breach the voter registration system and release information about who was registered and some private information about it. That's threat number one, and that's objective number one in our approach to make sure that the the voter registration system, the rolls, whatever it is that different that each state, wherever it is that they keep their voter information, is protected from attackers getting in. It's segmented in such a way, you know, it's got good solid privacy and security rules around it to give it every chance in the world to resist those kinds of attacks. So checking the voter rolls is number one. Second is to make sure that the right processes are in place, the right controls are in place, the right oversight, the right people, processes, technologies are put into place to make sure that the voting machines themselves are secure on voting day. Third is related to that. It's the auditability. It's the good you could think of it as a chain of custody of the vote as it goes from voting machine to aggregation, to tabulation, to even recounting. We want to make sure that the states have a secure and private process to be able to rely on those results as they're reviewed, as they're audited, as they're recounted. And that addresses the issues from California, where California was accused of allowing 3 million illegals to vote, up in New Hampshire, where they were accused of busing people from Massachusetts up to vote a second time in the New Hampshire, primaries. So those kinds of accusations did not necessarily, we want to give the states the ability to say, no, we've got a good process. We've got non-repudiation controls in place here. We can say our vote count is good and here's why, and start to stand up against those kinds of accusations.
Right. So, in the event that a losing candidate or in recent examples a winning candidate alleges voter fraud, there's more than just a trust us, we're professionals argument. There's actually some quantitative, verifiable audit trail that they can point to and say, here it is.
Exactly. Yeah, those were frightening allegations. The vote is rigged. I mean, coming down to election day, you want to be in the position to be able to say, no, it's not, and here's why, as a state, certainly. So that's that third objective. And then the fourth is to, as we know as security professionals, one of the most common ways to introduce a vulnerability into an enterprise is to make a change, right? And these guys, all the states are making changes. They're putting in e-poll books. They're putting in real-time registration application. So any change that they make over the course of the next year, 2 years, 3 years, we want to make sure that security and privacy are baked in development and deployment and acquisition, in testing and in every step of the way, from selection to actual implementation. So that's the fourth objective, is to make sure that new initiatives aren't introducing new exposures or new holes that attackers could get in through. So,
and does the kind of 80-20 law apply here? Is 80% of the problem here in one of those four things, or is the risk really spread pretty evenly across all four of those areas?
I think it's kind of like a blind man and the elephant thing. It depends on who you are. 80% of the stories are probably about voting machines, right? And the count being rigged. But I would say 80% of the risk is in the human factors, as it is just about anywhere else in any other industry, in about talking somebody into letting you have their password or providing access, or talking them into clicking on a link that's going to install some malware and get the voting information out.
So that chain of custody piece is important then.
Yeah, absolutely. Both for the vote totals and for the privacy of the voter rolls.
You had a huge federal investment in upgrading voting equipment after the 2000 election with the Help America Vote Act, HAVA, and you kind of threw a lot of federal dollars at localities to upgrade their voting infrastructure, but did so at a time when the technology, such as it was not particularly secure. It was kind of the early days of electronic voting, and there wasn't that much attention feature-wise to security. And so what you got is a big investment in insecure hardware. Going forward, the buyers here are not educated security-wise by and large, or they're local officials, town clerks and selectmen and so forth. How do we get them knowledgeable enough to discern between a secure platform and an insecure one that maybe costs a little bit less?
What I found is the election machine manufacturers have made some aggressive claims about what they have security and privacy wise that have been disproved by exercises like like a DEF CON. So I think you're exactly right. But how do we educate them? How do we take care of that problem? I'm not sure. I mean, I think reemphasize, maybe taking some of that emphasis that was placed on the technology and putting it on the awareness, education and awareness I mean, boy, you can look across all of technology history, and the first dollars go toward building a cool tool, right? Building a firewall or building an IDS or building something that's technically sound, and that's pretty fun. And then it's the next wave of dollars that go toward trying to educate the people and making them smart enough to do it.
Yeah.
I think that awareness is there, and I think that the exercises that the states that we're working with are going through is bringing that to the forefront, and there's a lot of knowledge sharing. I've been to the National Association of Secretary of State's meetings, and we're going to the National Association of State Election Directors meetings shortly, and there's a lot of talk about what works for you, what doesn't work, you know, a lot of panels that include representatives from every state who are talking about why are we in trouble right now, how do we get out of it, and these kinds of discussions are happening. So I think it's just kind of the natural progression of technology. First, you get all the cool, snappy technical stuff, and then you figure out what the controls that go around it are. And I think we're on the verge of putting the right controls in place to educate everybody and to control it properly.
So you guys are working with states. You're working with the state of Kentucky. You said they were brought in some of these cases very close to the 2016 election when some of the news broke about, you know, Russian hackers, you know, looking to sneak their way into state election boards. You know, there wasn't enough time to really do a lot there before the presidential election, but looking ahead to the midterm elections and then the 2020 presidential election, what is some of the work that you're doing with a little bit more runway to get some of these states up to speed and improve overall the security and integrity of the system?
So we're helping the states get to a point where they have a good vulnerability management program. A lot of them are getting help from DHS or from FBI and federal government sources about how the vulnerability management is working, pen testing, vulnerability assessment, also to look at architecture. But then, like I talked about, to take a look at who's responsible for what in the organization, who's made the decisions about segmentation, who's applying your local state laws for privacy to the whole enterprise and to all the practices. And then to getting into some of the really key questions of control to me are how do you get the consistency to happen at all of the different counties and all the different precincts? In a lot of states, the counties have a whole lot of autonomy. A lot of states, they can pick their own voting machines. They can, to a large degree, determine their own voting processes on election day. What we're doing in a lot of cases is figuring out how that director of elections gets control, you don't want centralized execution, but you want centralized control. You want to come up with a good set of repeatable standards and policies and processes that you know are going to be happening out at the localities. To me, that's the biggest area where we're able to help. How does it work right now? Look, you're pretty much uncontrolled at a lot of the counties, especially the more remote ones. So let's figure out a way, some good control, some good organizational, some good management mechanisms to make sure that, you know, you make a good decision about how you want to get your precinct set up on voting day in a secure and private way, and then a good set of controls to make sure that happens in the right way. So it's not, you know, it doesn't sound as sexy as some of the high-tech technical defenses, but that's where we find that we can do the most good, and that's where some of the hardest work has been.
Is there a federal role here? I know most people are in agreement that sort of the decentralized nature of the U.S. voting system in some ways is beneficial security-wise because there's no one point of control and there's a lot of diversity out there in the ecosystem. On the other hand, you know, some of the things you're talking about in terms of setting standards would make sense to do it nationally because, you know, a vote's a vote, right? No matter what state it's cast in.
Yeah, that's a really good question and a good point. The federal government has kind of found or sought a balance where it's offering services and is trying to offer services in a way that the states can kind of take them or leave them in a lot of cases. So that makes them, it appears to make them a little bit more neutral and, you know, they can't really put their fingers in the scales that they're being invited in. And that's what they've tried to set up, the MS-ISAC initiative and what DHS is doing and the FBI is doing. And when I was at the National Association of Secretary of States, there was a panel that everybody attended, was fascinated by, with DHS, FBI, and Secret Service all up explaining exactly what's available, what we can do to help you. We've got pen testing, we've got standards, we've got these common knowledge bases. So they're trying to basically provide tools that the states can take or leave at their desire. And I think anything more than that you start to lend the appearance of meddling, or maybe it makes it a little bit too easy to get involved. And I think they're rightfully very nervous about that.
Well, it often seems, you know, in the days either leading up to a big election, or particularly a close or contested one, and even sometimes the days following, you know, you hear these kind of on the rumor mill, like, oh, there was a last minute firmware update to the, you know, Sequoia systems in, you know, Wisconsin or whatever. And, you know, because so much of this is done in software, there is, you know, if you want to put on your tinfoil hat about this stuff, you really can. I mean, it's very hard to know, you know, what's that story about? And was there a software update and what was in it? And is that kosher? Is it not kosher? What's going on? You know, so it seems like there is always room, especially with electronic voting versus paper voting, for people to be suspicious or have doubts or think that something suspicious is going on.
Yeah, and the appearance of this of something going wrong can be as dangerous and hurtful to, you know, the democratic process as something actually happening. As long as it's just a few tinfoil hat wearers who are saying that, we're fine. But if that starts to become, you know, if you get 20-30% of the people or the electorate thinking, oh wow, these aren't safe, then yeah, you know, you're really messing with the outcome of an election at that point.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. You know, we saw the voting village at DEF CON last weekend. You know, by all accounts, the voting systems did not come out on top in that contest. you know, some of those were quite old, and some of them, in fact, I know at least one model that fared particularly poorly. You know, the company isn't even really in business anymore. But you know, these systems are still used. Is it the case that we need kind of a to press a reset button on some of the voting hardware and software that we're using, or can we patch and repair what's there enough to be assured that, you know, again, votes have integrity?
You're right. A lot of those were systems that were purchased out of eBay. They were older systems. We're looking at Sequoia and Diebold systems that we had already known, a couple of which had been compromised before. And you're right. It may not have been, in some cases, the up to date, fully patched, fully managed systems that are being used at the most advanced states at this point. So that is a concern. But the fact that the best results we're getting are from this independent group that are pulling in whatever they can find on eBay and finding whoever they can find to hack it and defend it, and that's the best source of data that we have right now. That's the concerning thing. There's no initiative there's no consortium to gather the voting machine manufacturers together to do this on a more formal basis, to have, you know, to do a vulnerability management program, to do security by design or security by deployment kind of thing. So to me, that's the thing that's missing, and that's what DEF CON shows. That there's no, if it has to be a government initiative, that might make sense. If it has to be some consortium of a private consortium, that makes sense. If it has to be a bunch of states banding together to say, you know, we'll only buy the certified ones, then that makes sense too. But, you know, that function has to happen better than just a bunch of guys buying stuff off of eBay and going and seeing if they can hack it, because we're missing a lot of information that way. We're missing the good information on the latest systems and the latest techniques. And, you know, I'm nervous about it.
That's a really great point, actually. I mean, that, Eric, that, you know, while, you know, I'm sure the voting system vendors would take issue with, oh, these are old systems. I mean, the answer to that is just as you said, which is, okay, well, where's your test bed? If this is subjective, where's the objective analysis of these systems? And you're right, it doesn't exist. It brings me to another point, which is a lot of these voting systems, all of these voting systems are, you know, proprietary devices. And often when you start asking pointed questions about how they work or their inner functions, you're running up against that's proprietary information, and those are trade secrets and so on. You know, the New York Times ran an op-ed this week saying that voting software should be open source and therefore auditable. What are your thoughts on that? How do you solve that question around, well, we're using private companies' technology to count votes, but we also need total transparency about how those votes are counted?
Yeah, it's another one of those weird balances, huh? But it's solved in private industry in a lot of ways. It's solved in the military in a lot of ways. You use a lot of proprietary technology made by private companies for, you know, SCI and top secret communications all the time. And what is the difference between the vote, how the voting machine folks go about their business? They're just, I don't know. I mean, they're just generally not as interested in going through that effort, either collectively or individually, to provide assurance to the public. You don't always have to be open source and show everybody what your code is, but you should be able to honestly say, here's the testing we've done. Here are the experts we've had look at it. Here is the, you know, we follow the, whatever it is, the whatever methodology you want to follow during your coding and development. And we had some really good auditors check it out and look it over. And we made a good investment in defense and security and privacy. And that seems to have been missing. And that the push seems to have been in the other direction. We've had, our team has had, for example, voting machine manufacturers who are trying to prevent us from using knowledge that we've gained on in one state about their machines during an engagement in another state. It's my impression, but that the voting machine, some of the voting machine manufacturers would prefer to, you know, rather than follow the philosophy of let's do this as a team and be as proactive as we can about it, they're trying to play defense and kind of hide the vulnerabilities that they do have in the first place without necessarily, you know, without necessarily addressing them or fixing them.
Wow. So you guys have come across, your researchers have come across vulnerabilities, and you want to kind of share that information between one Secretary of State's office or what have you, who's a client, and another state, and you're getting pushback from the vendor saying, you know, it's not your information to share.
But yeah, it's been enough of a concern that we, you know, we felt the need to create NDAs and non-disclosure agreements in certain ways that we protect ourselves from being potentially being
sued
or being
you know, have you been able to share that information though? More importantly, for the public standpoint.
Yeah, we have. We've figured out how to do that. It hasn't been with the full-throated support of the voting machine manufacturers, and it should be. You know, it really should be if you think about doing the right thing.
I always ask: Are there places that are really doing it well? Either, you know, it could be vendors, technology vendors, or states or countries. You know, looking outside the U.S., who, you know, to the best of your knowledge, really seem to be following best practices and have solved this problem. It seems like it's a solvable problem, but that have done a good job addressing it.
Yeah, it's a solvable problem. I kind of like, I mean, you have nations with a tradition of, you know, centralized control that where maybe you have fewer of the tinfoil hat wearing folks there than you do here. But, you know, a place like Estonia, for example, good centralized control, pretty open about what's going on. They've even been able to put like national authentication directories in place, and they do a lot more transacting online and a lot safer transacting online as a result. But a place, you know, we don't have that kind of a culture where we're that trusting, I think, of our government. So I'm not sure in America with our concerns and culture and, you know, and individual freedoms and you know, tradition of being concerned about what the federal government's doing if given too much power, I don't think a lot of that would fly here. There's been the belief or kind of the dogma within the states and the voting machine manufacturers that, hey, these systems are not vulnerable because they're not connected to public networks. And, you know, we're learning that there are vulnerabilities, that some of this information does traverse public networks sometimes, that there are wireless vulnerabilities here and there, that even if it's completely offline, you can still alter many votes at a time through certain techniques. So getting past that accepted truth of, hey, it's offline, so everything's safe, to starting to question what's going on, I think that's a great thing. That's a great outcome. It's kind of too bad that we didn't see these vulnerabilities before, but, you know, it doesn't seem to me as if voting count, I mean, as if a vote has been affected by hacking on voting days at this point. That's generally the consensus, I think, of the community. And, you know, and I think we're even improving from where we are. So, you know, I think generally it's positive, and generally the way we do things as a group, even though it's painful sometimes and we're fighting about it a lot and, you know, yelling and screaming at each other. I think just like with the rest of American government, it seems to get us to where we want to go.
Eric Hodge, Director of Consulting at CyberScout, thank you so much for coming in and talking to the Security Ledger. It was great having you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We were speaking with Eric Hodge, Director of Consulting at CyberScout. And we spoke with Bev Harris, the co-founder of blackboxvoting.org.